Welcome to the Literal Fiction Book Club, where we read books so you don't have to. My name is Sam Johnson, and joining me today is Alex.
Hey.
And Troy.
Hello, everybody.
This week, we are discussing Part 3, 4, and 5 from The Rise and Fall of the British Empire by Lawrence James. These three parts take us from the emerging dominance of British imperialism after the defeat of Napoleon in 1815 to its inevitable sunset at the end of World War II. The extent of the British Empire and its importance, for good or ill, is truly felt in James's account. From the imperial cooperation of the two world wars to the postage stamps decorated with oddities at the far reaches of the empire, James impresses upon us how the changing attitudes of all people inside the empire understood the project as a contradictory patchwork of progress, domination, prestige, and paternalism. Furthermore, James exposes the reader to the British Empire as a political entity, a living organism of indirect and directly ruled states and dominions full of a diverse range of people with political aspirations within and outside of that empire, rather than simply an inflexible iron fist, although there was plenty of that. Lawrence James' biography, taken from the back of the book. Lawrence James studied history and English at York University and subsequently took a research degree at Merton College, Oxford. Following a career as a teacher, he became a full-time writer in 1985. He is the author of 7 critically acclaimed works of nonfiction. He lives in St. Andrews, Scotland with his wife, who is headmistress of St. Leonard's School, and his 2 sons. How's it going, boys?
Good.
It's going.
So, did Alex, I know that you organized the Stop the Steal protest, right? That was your idea?
No, I was actually more involved in the protest against the mask mandate at Sununu's house. I was actually pretty involved in that one instead.
Okay.
You can't divide your energies in the face of tyranny, right?
Right, yeah. You have to leave other work to good patriots, you know, and trust that they'll do the right thing.
Q's holding down the fort, man.
So what did we... This was quite a bit of reading. We're doing our best to consolidate these longer books into fewer episodes because we don't want to drag it on if we don't have to, especially since largely the same themes are being used. But what did we think of this section, which covers the rise part or the has risen part to the fall of the British Empire? What do we think of the high point of imperialism?
It's always interesting to me that how short imperialism actually was. Like, I consider imperialism to truly be from like maybe 1750 through 1914. Like World War I, as we saw in this section, just it kills it. But the high period where there's like the scramble for Africa in the 1880s. And then the Edwardian push for the Pacific, and they divide up all the islands. Like, there are little intermittent bursts of it, but people always talk about imperialism like it's this some great gargantuan thing. We're really, like, the imperialism that people think of and fantasize but also hate on lasted for, like, 40 years. And it was, like, ascendant for 15 and then falling for, like, the next 50.
I mean, it's like peak also was, I mean, I know that's kind of necessarily how it is, but like, it's one of those things that was just so unsustainable that like, as it grew and as it peaked, it was like withering already. Like,
well, the circumstances that made it possible of somebody being like a century and a half ahead in weapon technology, like they're just going to win. Like, it's just kind of the way it is. Honestly, my favorite part is kind of in the late 1700s, like the Napoleonic age, where it's like disease and the technology's not that advanced, whereas like the Easterners still have a fighting chance, and it's like fun because you don't know what's going to happen, whereas gunboat diplomacy in the 1800s, they just roll up with machine guns, and it's like, well, you can't beat that with any amount of like effort.
It's just interesting just like how unsustainable it was, because like Every time they grew, it necessitated, you know, more of a military presence overseas. So like,
well, I mean, I think it was a combination of that, but also that the not only, I mean, you can look at different examples. I thought James did a good job of differentiating sort of like where like places like Canada or Australia or South Africa, which had, you know, a United Kingdom originated settlers, and you know, a place like India, which is more directly ruled. But I think part of it is that the, you know, the parts of the empires eventually had political aspirations of their own, right? And that great distance and the needs of Britain that needed to be met by the empire no longer worked for them. And eventually it became a question of, well, you know, can Britain enforce this? And because of, you know, the, as Troy pointed out, the technology gap became less stark, but also also because Britain itself became weaker over time compared to its adversaries. It, you know, eventually, I mean, in a lot of ways, it passed over to the United States to take up Britain's international role with varying results.
Britain being ascendant was just because they were the only game in town. Like, they were the only people in Japan in any large numbers, and in southern China and in India in any large way from like 1715 until at least another 120 years, because Europe was just like too embroiled in monarchical conflicts. I think what changed it though even more is just that the technology thing, yes, but it also awoke, like having a foreign power there awoke in nationalism in people. And like, I honestly think it started in France with the revolution, but it's like the fire was lit and literally all around the world, people started to just have a consciousness about themselves that never existed before. Like, nobody cared if land changed hands between different dukes. Like, they just own the land, they own you. But if you're like a part of a nation and a specific culture, like, I don't know, it's just so much stronger. And like, people all around the world immediately take it up. They're not half children that need 80 years of governance. Like, within a generation, people that are educated in Western ideas adopt them. And then that like makes empire impossible.
Yeah. And I mean, it's kind of England's fault too, in the sense that they consolidated these nations. They kind of birthed them and like a national identity. Mm-hmm. Like, India obviously didn't have a national identity, you know.
I mean, it wasn't really a nation at all.
Exactly.
It's a purely British invention.
You know? That's why it could be dominated. But then once they actually defeated all of the fiefdoms and turned them into states or counties or whatever, it became, you know, easier for them to have a national identity and to kind of, you know, revolt against their rule.
But they still also don't really even now. Like, there's so many different groups. There's so many religions and cultures within India. Like, yeah, there's one dominant faction overall. It's just, I think, more the numbers. Like, the British, they had so few people over there. They really were just resting upon, like, hey, we're trading. We're making you guys rich, kind of. We're making ourselves rich. But they didn't have, like, massive armies holding these people down. It really is amazing how much of it was just rested on prestige and, like, social power.
Yeah. And it was 65 million whites and 370 million people native to their countries. Isn't it like that the figure?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, I mean, part of it is just that, you know, when Britain needed to bring out the guns, it did, and it won, you know. Like, it wasn't like that the numbers weren't nearly as important. And, you know, I think that you could see in a lot of the quotes that Lawrence James put in there from people indigenous to the different British colonies, which is that they were constantly saddened by how far behind they were compared to the West in general, but Britain in particular. Like the quotes he took from Nasser as he was rising up the ranks in Egypt, and just, you know, how Britain could just have its way. It really didn't matter, you know, how many... if the majority was on the side of, you know, Egyptian nationalism, because Britain was just going to you know, protect its interests one way or the other.
Mm.
Yeah, I do think it's, well, I don't know. There's a lot of stuff that's interesting in this book, but especially India, how India really is the key to all of it. Like, I would say that the most interesting thing I've learned throughout this book is just one about public opinion of the empire, but really how the dominion system actually worked or how it came about. And in terms of running an empire, like, that's not a bad way to do it. Like, they did think that, okay, we're going to enlighten these people and then let them go. Or that's at least the lie they told themselves. But they actually, like, kind of started doing it, where they would give them self-government and allow them stuff. Like, they did learn after the American Revolution. And after reading this, I didn't realize how precarious their situation was after they lost that war. Like, I don't really think Britain was as much trouble until 1939.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. When Napoleon was on the rise, that was...
they were still secure.
It was about as close as it was going to get. I mean, not until the Battle of Trafalgar. If Napoleon wins the Battle of Trafalgar, there could easily have been an invasion in Scotland or Ireland. And nobody was really a match for that Napoleonic army.
True. I was thinking more about the empire falling apart, where it's like they had lost the colonies and the whole overseas empire could have fallen apart. Whereas in, like, by the start of World War II, it's a rickety machine. Like, it is definitely not doing well.
Yeah, and then you just have, like, the the old, like, Tory types, the Victorians, who are their only interest. And that was something that wasn't clear to me, because I don't normally read British accounts of World War II, is just how important the empire was to them, right? Like, it was almost a pathology, you know, how much they focused on that, and not only preserving it but expanding it, especially during World War II, because a lot of it was just kind of silly the way they were going about it. And, you know, as we saw in the, you know, we'll read shortly, but the result of all this is Britain didn't have an empire, you know, after 1970 or whatever. So, yeah, I mean,
I don't think there's any situation in that it could. I foresee no situation where they could have kept it beyond, like, World War II or not. It just, I don't think it's possible to keep people down when they're educated and the technological gap is closed. Like, you just can't do it.
I feel like they probably would have just kept relying increasingly on like the cruelty. Mm. Like, that seemed to be kind of like their mindset, was they had to start going back to that because, you know, the economic interests weren't there for the people who were colonized or were part of the empire. You know, they could no longer make the case that it's in your economic best interest to be part of this empire. Because once the technology is in the hands of that nation, you know, it's theirs for the taking.
Well, and it was never in really the economic interest of the people there. I mean,
kind of disagree.
You know, obviously, I mean, of India.
I definitely disagree.
I think it was in the economic
interest of Indians that the British were.
I mean, they brought a modern standard of living to the continent. I'm not saying that, like, what they did was good or defending it. I don't think you know what I mean. But they brought
the economic standard, the Western world living was raised.
Yes, they brought literacy. Specifically, they talk about how literacy was increased to like 70% in some parts of India. They brought modern medicine. They brought, like, the fucking
schools and hospitals,
train,
and railroads,
factories. Like,
I am not arguing that the benefits of civilization did not make it to India. I'm just saying that, like, for many Indians, depending on what policies the British pursued, you know, for instance, when they basically destroy the textile industry of India in order to be able to sell textiles to India from Britain, mm-hmm. you know, like, it's not as clear as, like, you know, yeah, okay, maybe the average standard of living, and there are some, you know, important additions to Indian society that Britain brings, but I would say it's more so about the interests of the, you know, the rulers in India that are being met, you know, because, yeah, at the end of the day, it's enforced at the, you know, point of a bayonet. It's not really about, you know, it's what's good for Britain's commercial interests, not really for, you know, incidentally, it might be good for the people in India in a given region.
Right. But I mean, unfortunately,
but it still happened. They still got that benefit.
And the peasants don't incidental. And the peasants don't control the political destiny of India.
I agree with you. Yeah. I'm just saying is that when we were talking about it's a whom question. So we're talking about, like, saying that the breakup of the empire you know, it wasn't really due to the vast majority of Indians no longer seeing the commercial or, you know, the benefit of it. It was, you know, for the whatever the leadership amongst the amongst India, you know, the Congress and, you know, the people who went to Western schools and became educated in Western political ideas, that they no longer saw the benefit to it, because really most of Britain's rule was through like a vassal system in India, not really by appeasing the masses, but by appeasing, you know, the people who had authority in the region.
Right.
Until they just took it over. Like in this period, we see them just get rid of inefficient or ineffective clients and they just set up a British administration, which I think is weird and like not at all similar to other empires, that they had a culture of kind of an imperial trade-based bureaucracy. Like that definitely wasn't the case in France, where it was like basically just the military was sent out and it conquered and criminals were sent there and on and on. It's just like, I don't know, it's very distinctly British.
I mean, I think India is also special, right? Because like you don't really see that same pattern emerge in any of the other dominions except for India, because it's because the British ruling class is so focused on protecting India. I mean, most of their Middle Eastern activity was with the idea of defending a land route to India.
Yeah, everything is about India. Their policy in Sudan, Egypt, South Africa, Iraq. Everything is based around how do you get to and control India? Because if you lose that, the game's over.
And when they did lose it, the game was over.
It's true. Yeah, it ended pretty goddamn fast after India left.
I did find it interesting how, like, how the idea of Pakistan was created so kind of like late in the game, you know, like I think it was what, like the 1920s is when James said it was kind of thought of, after a split within the sort of Muslim Hindu blocks in India. But that's a whole thing. And I guess it makes more sense to me now why India and Pakistan hate each other.
Yeah. I do think I support kind of the imperialists in this period where they're talking about the Indian Congress and growing democracy. Like democracy, when it's not rich, is not a pretty thing. When it's poor, it's like blood feuds between clans. And in India, it's religion, like the Hindus and Muslims and the Sikhs, and basically everybody in the Muslims hate each other. And like, as soon as the British leave in the 40s, it's like an immediate genocide of a million people between Pakistan and India. So like, in terms of, I do think the British committed some pretty horrible things. And answering my own question that I put, I think the worst one of what they did in this section was 1919 in, what is it, Armistice in India, where there's like a unit that just enjoyed mowing people down and they kill like 500 people or something.
At the protest where he just fired like volley after volley into the masses.
Yeah, they just keep firing and the unit was just like, yeah, we enjoyed killing them. Anyway, that stuff is like the worst, in my opinion. That was the darkest period of the empire. But like you get it where they leave and then, okay, there's no overarching, in their view, civilization or just order. And then all the different groups start to vie for power and they're horrible to each other, even worse than the imperialists were.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, to go off your question, and you were answering the one about what do you think was the best foreign policy feat for the British during this period and what was their biggest mistake, right?
Yeah, I think that was the biggest mistake, is the massacre at Amistir. Like that was a big I don't know. It tarnishes the reputation of what the empire is supposed to stand for.
I would say this might be a hot take. I think Britain's biggest mistake was fighting in World War One. I don't think they should have done that. As far as like preserving the empire, and you know, in Britain's interest, I think that was their biggest blunder, getting involved in that particular European war, because they would not have been in as a precarious situation in the interwar period. They would have more flexibility and they wouldn't have to become debtors to the Americans. And likely the whole fascism, well, the whole Nazism thing, at the very least, I'm pretty sure Mussolini still would have come to power, but I don't really think Hitler would have if Germany had won that war. The British in particular were in a plenty fine position to resist German imperialism on the high seas, if not necessarily in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
That goes back to their very first foreign policy thing, even before the idea of we have to make sure that everything is about preserving the empire and preserving trade, and then specifically about the dominions. Like, their very first thing is that we have to have the biggest navy, because they had to beat Spain in 1588. And then the next policy thing was like, we have to defend whoever controls Belgium, because if whoever controls Belgium, then they can very easily do an invasion and just conquer us, and the fleet is of no use. So it's like they opposed Napoleon primarily because of that. And it's basically like whoever was the hegemon on the continent, they were opposed to. Like, I feel like they had to be involved in World War One. It was really stupid how they fought it. And it's also super tragic that that was the high point of imperialism. Like, everybody answered the call of hurrah, like, be a man. And then they got fucking mowed down on the Somme. Like, right. That was the death of the empire, is the Western Front. But I feel like they had to, because if Germany conquered France, which they would have, it would have been Germany takes over their colonies, and then all of a sudden it's like Britain versus Germany, and Germany has the continent. So it's like they would have overpowered Britain if they had won the war.
And I think, like, what you kind of mentioned about, like, how war changed is something that, like, also just, like, the conception of war and, like, the people's, like, you know, the viewpoint of your upper crust British person in terms of their willingness to go to war. Like, you needed that spirit, that, like, enthusiasm for battle that I think you can only have if you're just, like, totally used to winning constantly and fighting, outgunning absolutely, like, your enemy. And, like, once that was shook, like, you know, and it shows, like, they could barely get Australia to line up with them. Like, they needed that. They needed that, like, psychological tool to enable, like, to make your average British, like, rich guy willing to even go to India.
Mm. Like, right, that, yeah, I mean, you just, and it was weird how the prestige of the empire kind of outlasted its actual ability to enforce it. And it was, like, the cracks were revealed seemingly a lot later than they initially appeared. I did
when
really
do you
like
think they came. When do you think they started the cracks versus when they showed up?
I think it, I would say, I think as early as like 1900, like at that point, I think Britain was already sort of losing its grip on the, like on South Africa and Canada and Australia. Obviously the troubles in Ireland, I think that the reason why I say there are cracks is because they actually had to turn to, it wasn't just gunboat diplomacy anymore, right? Like, they had to directly involve themselves in struggles for national existence. And they couldn't simply just threaten to, you know, to go forward and have that high, but they actually had to deliver on it. And there was, you know, they were pretty effective in that regard, but you know, to control that much land with such a small population is incredibly difficult, and they basically were being challenged from, you know, every sector of the empire. So Alex says a good thing here. So you were mentioning before we started here how you thought what Gandhi said about the Japanese during World War II was pretty funny. What did James say about that?
Yeah, that Gandhi was under the impression that a Japanese invasion of India would be much better than having British control, because he felt that the Japanese would be much more sympathetic to his form of spiritual nonviolent resistance, which is probably like he's lucky it didn't happen, because that's like one of the dumbest takes of all time. like looking at how like the Japanese Empire treated its colonial territories during the 30s and 40s. Like, I can't imagine anything more horrifying.
Yeah, he literally was going to be like, I'm going to do a peaceful protest against this fascist. They would put a bullet in you. That's what Stalin told Churchill to do that. He's like, yeah, you should just round up those people and execute everybody in the Congress. He literally told Churchill Jesus to Christ. Do that.
Efficient guy.
Yeah, the man can get things done. It's a horrible take.
It's horrible. I mean, at least like the British, I don't know. They claim to believe that they were culturally superior, but they thought that the Indian man could be like raised up to the standards of you know, the British person. The Japanese are not going to think that about you. They don't give a fuck.
Like, also, it's just the British like sense of judicial importance. Like, people say law and order, and I don't really agree with that. Like, American and especially British culture is just based on like the law has importance, or their judicial matters will settle things, and it has led to rights and all those different things, and that would make them much less likely to execute Gandhi versus him going to somebody being like, oh my god, you like Zen, I am also a nonconformist, or a no, it would not have worked.
Mm-mm. No, and yeah, Alex, like you said, the rapaciousness of the Japanese Empire and evidence of its like activity in Manchuria and Korea pretty much lends itself to the fact that whatever resistance Gandhi was going to do is going to be met with a tremendous amount of force. I think that it's like one of those things where like both alternatives kind of blow, you know, like it's not like the British did a very good job in India in many degrees. But, you know, similar to how I think on the whole, right, like British rule is preferable to Mughal rule. I think it's also preferable to Japanese rule.
Yeah. I mean, is for what it's worth, at least with the British, you had the Labour Party like on your side. There's no Japanese Labour Party at this point.
No, there isn't now.
I don't even know. Yeah, I don't even know what they're.
They have a, it's a one party state.
Is it still?
Yeah, just one party.
Damn. All right. I didn't even know that.
Yeah. So one thing that James mentioned was I want to know more about the interwar period in general, because it's such a crucial time that is not really touched on in either like popular media or history as much as I have engaged with it. But James is talking about how the British ruling elite put the empire before everything else while it was preparing for war with Germany. And that was, there was this kind of touch and go nature of it, because the ruling class was very aware of sort of the critical importance of the empire, but there was a lot of guilt and just like general malaise about the empire after World War One. And James sort of makes the claim, or tries to contradict their claim of like the left wing, which is talking about imperial, like what the actions of the British government were only to sort of consolidate trade and capitalism. And so what do you guys think of like the late Victorian ideology, trying to revive sort of a past imperial glory? And do you think James is right in his assessment that this, you know, it was more of a loyalty to the empire rather than, you know, simply a matter of maintaining capitalism or British, you know, commercial interests?
I mean, it seems like commercial interests are like the key that binds the colonial possessions together. Like, you can't really separate them at all, especially for the colonies like Canada and Australia and South Africa to an extent, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm basically agreeing with that. I thought it was a kind of a vulgar criticism, but I don't normally see people contending with that, you know? So I was wondering if either of you had any thoughts that would kind of like back up James's point of view.
I agree with James that people, they put their whole heart into the philosophy. Like, yeah, it's about them making money and trade and being and staying in power. But it's that idea of the prestige and like what the British Empire is and what a British man is, about being like adventurous, spread out everywhere, able to survive everywhere, rugged, loves team sports, apparently, is necessary.
Stoic and Christian.
Yeah, stoic, Christian, violent, orderly. I feel like they needed to keep all of that. And for it, you have to put that idea first. Because if they lose it, like, what is England just by itself? Like, look at England now. They're not doing so hot now that they've left the EU. They've already lost Ireland. They almost lost Scotland a couple years ago. Like, without the empire without that prestige, they are just a tiny little island.
It's true.
They have to defend that. They have to put it before everything. Although I think in the interwar period, I was actually quite put off by, well, both American isolationism. I just think that's a really dumb policy. But then also the pacifism in European countries was just like, it's almost gross and shameful. Like just acquiescing to these horrible things and the horse trading of just like selling colonies between people to appease dictators. It was such a stark difference too between in 1914 and 1918, the heyday of patriotism. It's like such a weird, stark difference. But it is interesting that the idea of the empire is the one thing that like stays there continually. It's just we have to maintain it, we have to uphold it, even throughout all these pendulum swings of like jingoism, pacifism, patriotism, on and on and on. But no, I think they actually did believe in it more than just the trade, because you have to have a philosophy that justifies what you're doing.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you, Troy. Yeah, I mean, to your point, Troy, about the pacifism, I mean, well, you know, that's the British ruling elite's fault. Like, you know what I mean? Like, they sent them into the meat grinder, and people didn't want to have another European war after that whole experience. They were hardly in a position by the time they realized they were in danger to really do much of anything about it.
Okay, more character... think Neville Chamberlain is just a twat. I just hate Neville Chamberlain.
Well, fucking Lawrence James thinks the same, because he had nothing good to say about him. Whatever he called him, like, you know, a vain and whatever self-important individual, which is like the British equivalent, or the posh equivalent of the N-word. just in general, like the pacifist mood kind of like, you know, it's like how they navigate these different situations. And I think that, you know, the long tradition that was only really broken, like for real in World War II of America, you know, minding its own hemisphere, you know, it served American interests well up to that point. I mean, it really served American interests well in World War II, because they got all of the spoils and none of the destruction. But yeah, it's a complicated thing. And I also think that like the character of fascism in particular, right, that fascism wasn't merely just another political representation of, you know, normal quote unquote imperialism. That wasn't obvious at that time. I mean, we can see it in retrospect now, but you know, at the time it wasn't clear that, you know, they're actually you know, in the way James put it, was like, you know, you give them concessions, but they'll, you know, they're really just, they see that as a sign of weakness where they can take bigger prizes.
And in the view of the British public too, they said, like, obviously people didn't know that the concentration camps were coming, but it's like already by 1938, everybody knows that this regime is just brutal. Like, they are dictatorial and they're terrible to their own people, which makes it even more heinous that you're just acquiescing and you're just going to give them, this person, a colony. Like, I understand why people would be upset with their leaders about that.
Right, yeah. No, I mean, I don't know. It's a hard thing to navigate, but obviously I think it would have been preferable if, you know, Britain and France did advance work on the German military before it was, you know, on a roll.
Yeah, they mentioned that the idea of a Copenhagen-style attack was ruled out multiple times, which, like, destroy the fleet in a harbor as a preemptive attack. Worked in the Napoleonic Wars, And then later with Churchill, they do it again in the Mediterranean, and it works again. They hold the Mediterranean because of it. Like, they sink an Italian fleet, they sink a Vichy France fleet. I don't know. I just, whenever the British do get their fighting pride back because Churchill's such a good orator, they like actually start to turn things around, even though they're taking bloody noses left and right.
I mean, their preparedness for the Blitz is pretty impressive. Like, I know, I guess that was obvious to them. That was like the only option Hitler had, I guess. But like, that's a, like, I don't know. Growing up, like, I would always read about that and be like, that must have been just like such a harrowing time to like live in England. Like, that would get your spirit up in its, or at least your hatred of the Germans up at the very least.
Yeah.
Like, nothing brings it home quite like that. And that was like, that's the first time it gets brought home like that in the entire book, for sure, right? Yeah.
I mean, it's still there. That's their policy about having the largest navy, is to prevent that from ever happening. Like, they always have that existential angst about an invasion fleet, but a little bit in World War One and then a shit ton during the Blitz, it actually comes home because there's a bomb coming through your window.
Yeah, I mean, nothing like creating national unity, you know, like being under attack from a common enemy. So, and I think after, you know, after reading this book, I have a much greater appreciation for, you know, why occasionally I'll come across interviews with like old timer British people for, you know, obviously not being interviewed about the empire, but about different things. And they have a kind of a quiet confidence about them, about, you know, who they are and what they did. And often they come from that generation of either World War II or immediately afterwards. And, you know, I think that it's, they're resigned kind of like, cause they grew in a time of decline for their nation. But they strike me as particularly purposeful, right? In a way that I would say Americans try to recreate what the World War II experience, like in a propagandic way, but wasn't necessarily true at the same scale.
No, just like outside of like the reaction to Pearl Harbor, maybe, but even that's not as, it's not the same thing.
Well, the Brits knew, James mentions it, that the first war, everyone was feeling the jingoism spirit of like, yeah, we're going to slap around the Huns, we're going to teach them. But then in World War II, they're like, shit, this is coming, but we have to do this. And then also, like, in terms of going out with a bang or the thing that ended their empire, like, Churchill was the right person at the right time. And then they do come back. Like, everybody thinks it's Britain versus Hitler alone, which is impressive. But Britain was at war with Japan and Italy and Germany alone and surviving while being attacked on all fronts all over the world.
I had never thought about it in that way, but like James definitely frames it that way. And I guess I had never, like, as an American, obviously I hadn't had reason to, but I'd never thought about World War II in that way. Like that 1941 to 43 period. Like, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, I agree. I would say that the Far East experience was not, I wouldn't say they were, I guess, technically at war with Japan, but a lot of times they were more so worried about it and couldn't do anything with it.
Then it actually happened and they just got steamrolled.
Right. You know, you have Australians freaking out that the Japanese invasion is going to materialize. And a lot of that just falls to the Americans when the time comes. But yeah, I mean, as far as like that, the active resistance of the Battle of Britain and then the operations in North Africa, you know, for such a tiny nation, they figured it out, you know, and the, you know, being able to bring, I mean, obviously Pearl Harbor had, you know, the most to do with the United States entering the war, but even being able to involve the Americans in the Lend-Lease program and, you know, strengthen those ties is it's a feat of British statesmanship, right, and diplomacy. Because it really isn't, I mean, obviously it's in America's interest to have Britain around, but that is, you know, that's still not immediately clear in those years. You know, Britain had been a not a traditional enemy, maybe, but, you know, kind of a frenemy up to that point.
I like that we have a special relationship with England.
I do too. And that it used to be like really up until the 1880s, they were the designated enemy. Like, yeah, we were going to fight them, but it's like, fuck it, we're fighting England because we're still the rebel country. Us in Australia, we're like the child that got kicked out of the house for doing drugs. Australia's the ruly one.
Mm.
South Africa.
We're the rich one.
South Africa's the kid that gets into skinhead music. India's the adopted kid.
South Africa's definitely the school shooter.
And Canada's the good kid. Canada's the A.
I mean, Canada outside of Quebec sucks, dude. Fuck off with that. Fuck off with that.
You fucking French Canadian asshole.
Dude, I like Canada. Canada's got some cool stuff. There are brethren. There are North American. I feel more kinship with Canadians and Australians than I do with the British.
Oh, yeah. Well, we've got, like, I mean, with Canada, we've just completely colonized their popular culture to the point that, like, you know, they're like a state almost. I mean, I know they're not. They have their own little laws and stuff. I mean, England, too. If you look at what happened this summer, like, it just shows the fact that the American mind virus has infected British people to the point that they think that they're Americans. I mean,
oh, yeah, 100%.
It's incredible. It's really like fucking something else, dude.
It's really since the internet, though. Like, I have heard a lot of people in German-speaking world think the same thing, like, especially since they're basically colonized after World War II. But just, like, everybody looking around being like, what the fuck about Americanization of culture? And, like, really since everything, you can get everything online now. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I don't want to say it's tragic, but there's some pretty sad elements to that.
Yeah, and I would also say that the American culture that we're exporting is not exactly the most like fulfilling or satisfying culture.
No,
that one could get.
It's dog shit. I mean, I think that like, I don't know. I don't think that American culture has been particularly like awesome since 2001. I mean, obviously the aughts were kind of a low point, but I don't know.
Yeah, we have not been I wouldn't say we've been a vibrant culture recently.
No.
I mean, you would say like, you know, stagnant, let's contrast that to the, let's contrast this idea with the book and, you know, the British exporting of its culture, you know, for not obviously to the, not really desired by most of the British, but what ended up happening is that their culture, through education, you know, makes it into the minds of the colonial subjects, and then those that eventually leads to these independence movements, you know. But I don't see anything that America's exporting is, you know, having that kind of consequence, except for, you know, really to have I don't know, crowds in England talk about police brutality like it happens there, you know. I don't think anything of that magnitude will occur because of American culture exports.
No, because all we're exporting is kind of like gross consumerism.
For sure.
You know, not to be a lib about it, but it's funny. I remember growing up, like my mom being like, you know, always talking about how like the French were like so like ahead of the time. I don't know if you had this experience growing up, but she'd always
No, my parents hate France.
Well, respect to them, they should. But like, my mom would always be like, oh yeah, I don't know why I remember this, but like her telling me that like French movies and books and fashion were always like kind of like ahead of the curve. And like, that's no longer the case at all, I don't think. In terms of like the cultural zeitgeist, like I don't think that's even close to the case. It's definitely not really the case with British people either. It's weird to see that happen in the last like 30 years. And it hasn't happened for a good reason.
Well, I think it was just also the institutions that make these people famous or make us all feel the awe about them. We're not like consuming the propaganda in the same way. And I just feel like our zeitgeist is so bitter and cynical about things because we also do have the internet and we can just see everything. Mm-hmm. We're like much less likely to buy into or believe anything. Because a lot of the time when Britain was going conquering the world, mainly on prestige and a couple instances of gunboat diplomacy, it was just like the shock and awe of it. Once you become desensitized to it, people fight back.
Yeah, I mean, we're not exporting liberal democracy like the British were.
No, the world speaks English because of Britain, not us. We just got that benefit on the side.
The equivalent of like what we're exporting is identity politics, I guess.
Gross.
To the English speaking world. I don't know about otherwise, but that's what we're exporting to England.
Yeah, it's really disturbing. Their version is even more sickening than the American version, in my opinion.
Well, it just doesn't make any fucking sense. It just doesn't make any sense. Like, it's just like, I mean, that's a horror. We should export the Bill of Rights to England. Like, that's what they need.
Yeah, they fucking need that. Jesus, yeah, exactly.
I'm down with the Brits that want to abolish the monarchy. Because it costs.
Yeah, and the House of fucking Lords.
The House of Lords is even worse than the monarchy. At least the monarchy is like, it's honestly probably a net W for them just because.
Oh, yeah, for the prestige, for sure.
For the prestige, for the museum factor, and for the tourism and all that stuff. Like, I'm obviously opposed to the monarchy having any real power, but I kind of support the country just keeping it going because it's cool. But in the same sense that you keep a museum going, I don't think that the Queen should be the landlord for the country. The House of Lords is that they actually have power. That's crazy.
Yeah,
it blows my fucking mind when they tried to get the House of Lords involved to block Brexit.
Oh my god.
I mean, if you are like a Lib Dem or something, just like kill yourself.
For real. I mean, I can't believe that they fucking did that.
I'm friends with Lib Dem or former people that were formerly Lib Dems. I think the party's officially dead now.
Is it?
I think
so. Yeah, but they still have former Lib Dems in the fucking House of Lords.
Yeah.
But they couldn't win a goddamn popular election to save their lives.
Yeah.
Ugh. I mean, it's not like I like Nigel Farage anymore. Well, he's at least funny.
Anymore.
at least he's funny. You know, at least he told Belgium to their face what they really were.
Dude, I like Boris Johnson. Like, back in the day, I remember I liked him when he was the mayor of London because he was just a clown and he would like debate people on ancient history because he studied it at Oxford or Cambridge or something. He's much more fun version of Trump.
He's got that charismatic
buffoon.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it. Yeah, like Labour doesn't have, I don't know, I guess I don't know enough about it. It doesn't seem like they've got that awful.
Dude, Labour has nothing. Like,
awful.
Our country is bad. Our country is in a very bad spot overall. But Britain, woof, like out of the pan into the fire kind of thing.
I mean, what they've been brought down to is like...
Exactly.
It's incredible.
Quarter of the world to now they don't even have fucking Scotland. Like, what is next? Is Wales going to secede? Christ, yeah. Cornwall.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all if Scotland or Wales secedes. Like, it doesn't make a fucking difference. Like, it really, yeah, I don't, it just does not. It doesn't. Why even bother keeping them? It's not a, you know what I mean?
The oil off of Scotland is the reason they keep it.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a good reason then, I guess. But, like, it's, why even have a United Kingdom?
Yeah, why not just have England? I mean, that's where things are headed, right? Like, the final end of all of the English Empire, you know?
It's just London.
The only thing that'll be... Right, it'll just be...
And that takes it back to 1708. That would be so sad if the United Kingdom officially broke apart between Scotland and England. That'd be utter
tragedy. How does that work? So is it... The United Kingdom is... Isn't that Ireland, England, and Scotland?
Northern Ireland,
right.
Occupied Ireland.
Occupied Ireland.
Actually, so Armistice was the worst, like, event that took place in this time period, but the worst policy blunder was losing how badly they fumbled and lost Ireland. That actually, I do think, killed the empire. More than
the black and tans, dude.
Yeah,
those are some fucking assholes.
Isn't? Oh my god! I am very much excited to read that book when we get to it.
The Scorching Wind.
Yeah, the cloak and dagger aspect of the black and the tans, just like unmarked military police officers everywhere up against terrorists. Like, oh god, it's so good. The like romanticism and the danger of it, but absolutely chaotic.
Mm.
That's so fucking cool.
I really want to watch the movie with you guys if you want to. The Wind That Shakes the Barley.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've mentioned this. I do want to watch that.
I really like that movie. And I remember going on like IMDb and all the reviews are like, the British weren't that bad. You know, it like portrays them as like subhuman dogs.
Jesus fucking Christ. Good. Yeah. I would say, Troy, that the Armistice, you know, might be one of the single worst events as far as that's concerned. But I would say that, like, you know, things like the whole orchestration of the Opium War were, like, as far as like a human suffering quantifying, were like, you know, that's what I think of when I think of, you know, the very dark and cynical side of the British Empire.
Oh yeah, well, I was being dark and cynical. I wasn't saying what's the worst thing they done. I was thinking like, what's the worst for them? What's the worst thing that happened for them? Ireland was the worst thing overall. Armistice was the worst event. Oh yeah, the Opium War is evil.
Also, and by the way, he just like glosses over that. Like he, you know, really as far as I am at least somewhat sympathetic to the critiques of this book as imperial apologism, because he just doesn't mention like the worst things that it happened, right?
He does glance, like, I don't know, I forgive him because he's literally writing like 450 years of history, and he does mention atrocities. Like, he does mention them. He just, like, mentions them in one paragraph, and then he moves on.
My point is that we had, and I appreciated it, we had, like, four pages on stamps and movies, okay? And we could get more than the Opium War happened, and there was, you know, this expedition led by, you know, Lord so-and-so to go put it down, or to go put down whatever, like, uprisings were happening. So I'm somewhat sympathetic. I don't think it's as extreme as people make it out to be. And I mean, I think that that James has a kind of like a Gladstonian point of view. That's what I picked up on, that he really liked gunboat diplomacy and was really sad that it was not the way in which Britain continued to do its empire. But yeah.
And I mean, like, the Opium Wars in the context of the 19th century in China, I don't know if it's fair to provide context, but like, the suffering that was going on in China, like, was far beyond that, if that makes any sense. Like, yes. Their civil wars were, I mean, it'd be interesting to read a book on it, because, like, obviously he's not going to go deep on it. This isn't a book about China, but I mean, the mass loss of life is crazy.
We're talking 60 million deaths.
Yeah. You know? So like, you know, how big of a deal is the Opium Wars, and how big is the introduction of opium? Like, it's, you know, I'm not defending it at all, but like, there's context. Right. But like, he also glosses over the introduction of gin to Africa. Well, he talks about it a bit, but like, same concept, like, same idea. Like, alcoholism has like fucked up large swaths of Africa.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Like, mm-hmm. I mean, obviously a lot of shit fucks up Africa, but like, you know, that was this the same concept essentially. Because like, what it was, this kind of gin. What was it?
I don't remember what you're talking about.
You know,
wasn't it? Is it Nigerian?
It was something, right? Yeah, it was like a kind of gin that was like, that James said was like toxic, but like,
oh,
the ground was littered with bottles in the cities and stuff.
Oh damn!
Right,
I don't know.
Uganda, there's a really bad like scourge of banana liquor. You can like distill it and basically make vodka out of it. People just get fucking wasted on it. Just drink it straight. It's like moonshine.
Yeah,
just drink it straight.
Good. Yeah, God. There's a YouTube video I watched a while ago about like I don't remember where it was, but it was in Africa, about like the moonshine epidemic, and they're, you know, it makes bathtub gin in the 20s look good, you know.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, dude, I've had some of it. It's good.
Good.
What I had was, it wasn't good, but like, it wasn't as bad as I was expecting. It was all I'm trying to say. It was like, it was passable. It was strong as fuck, but it's strong as fuck. One little capful, I took a sip, and I was like, oh, damn.
Have you guys ever taken shots of Everclear?
No, thank God.
Yeah.
Not. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
I've seen what that does to people. Nasty stuff.
It reminds me of that scene in Sutri where, like, the very beginning of the book.
Which one? They're handing around that thing.
Early times, like, Sut.
Yeah, early times.
Oh, my God, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
It's got, like, twigs and branches in it. Like, that's a really funny scene. Every time I see early times whiskey in the store, I always, in my head, I'm like, early times, Sut. Or, like, get you a drink, Sut.
Oh, geez.
Man, I know you guys don't like that book, but I love that book. Every time I think of it, my heart gets warmed, dude.
I enjoy writing, but I may not enjoy certain things. Like, there were some very good scenes in Sutri. I thought it was a good book. It's just Cormac McCarthy's style grates on me sometimes.
Oh, yeah, I would not want to exclusively read his books.
It grates on me all the time. But yes, I agree with the... The thing is, I think it's a good book. Just Cormac McCarthy gets in the way, you know, like
it's an awful first Cormac McCarthy book in retrospect.
Yeah, and I think too that like it's just too busy, and that's really what you know. I mean, that's for some people, and it's not for others, you know. But he is a master of comedic situations. That come off as like a dark comedy kind of thing, and I think that it's you know it's very very strong at points and then kind of weak in others, but I understand why people like it.
Like you said, he needed a better editor.
Yeah, right. I did want to ask though. So we talked about the biggest mistakes of the British Empire, but what do we think? We want to be both sidesy about this, right? So what do we think was the best thing about the British Empire from a foreign policy point of view or just in general? Like, what do we think was the best thing to happen because the British Empire existed?
Forceful or enforcement of anti-slavery. Yeah. Like, once they embraced it, they're like, we're the first people to outlaw slavery. And then they like actually used their power to do something about it.
I was going to say that too. Yeah. I mean, that's the most like striking thing that I didn't really know about prior to this. Mm. Like their willingness to attack Portuguese slavers or Arab slavers, like that's crazy.
Yeah, that's actually, I was gonna say the revolutionizing of the colonies in general, right? Like bringing, like in many ways, you know, as we talked about previously, the development was uneven and not pleasant for many of the colonies, but you know, we wouldn't have, as imperfect and fucked up as it is, the, you know, Indian parliamentary system that we have today, right? Like it would not exist without Britain there, laying the seeds sort of unbeknownst to them of what would happen in the future, or, you know, the rise of Irish republicanism. South Africa is kind of a just net L, I would say. But, you know, I mean, even like American democracy, you know, like those the founding fathers, such as they're known, they understood themselves as English subjects and built their ideas off of the basis of English law and English liberty. So I think that the exportation of that is you know probably the greatest sort of heritage of the British Empire.
You know what, thinking about it, Sam, I agree with that. Just like there are obviously other cultures have had republics and civil rights before, but like modern democracy, modern ideas of rights are like very firmly Anglo-Saxon, like, or its children. Like if you think about major democracies in the world today, most of them are because of England.
Right. I mean, You could even say that the French Revolution was a circuitous route from England to America to France, right?
Like, and England played a big story in that, too, or a big part in theirs as well.
And I mean, the anti-slaving is just an extension of those concepts, you know, applied.
Right.
I think their other best thing was that they actually protected minorities. Like part of the reason we revolted against them is once they kicked the French out, they're like, they told the Indians, they're like, no, we're actually going to like watch out for you guys. And they tried to prevent them from basically having alcohol forced on them, having their land just blatantly taken or squatted on. And then they did the same thing in South Africa. I actually do want to talk about South Africa because I thought that was the most interesting, like, one-off, just weird. So they're like Dutch settlers because it was a Dutch colony until the second Anglo-Dutch War in the 1660s when they took it from them. It's at the same time that the British took New York and, well, took New Amsterdam and renamed it New York. But it's like the Dutch colonists, the Boers, and all of them, there's like their virile hatred for black people. Like there's racism in the empire, but then it's like the colonists, wherever there's like actual contact between these societies, the hate is just so fucking intense. It's kind of shocking to me, honestly, like seeing the evils in the West Indies and then just seeing the outright racism and the will for an apartheid state from the Germanic Dutch settlers is just, I don't know. I don't know how to describe it. It's crazy.
Mm. Well, Alex is our resident South Africa expert. So what do you think?
How am I the resident South Africa expert?
You're always watching YouTube videos about that area. You know,
that's true. In research for this project, please.
Yeah, I mean, South Africa is fucked up, and I'm pretty passive when it comes to historical racism. Like, you know, a lot of it is just general social thought. You know, an extension in, you know, either a paternalistic or a vitriolic way of that white man's burden that is constantly bandied about. But as far as South Africa is concerned, you know, I would say what's striking about it is that there's no they are crass, right? So like even when you think of the American South, right, like rampant with racism, but like with this veneer of politeness that kind of goes along with it, and everything is sort of acted out in the shadows, like those Boers and South Africaners, like, whew, they really just like they are out and out with it, right? Like there's no veil between them and what they want. They're just gonna say it and they're gonna go do it. And that's what I found most shocking.
Yeah. I try to think about these societies because, like, most of them are colonial. Because it's like in Europe, people didn't like black people. They thought they were better than them. They thought that it was like the natural order of things. Like, I feel like in the high tide of imperialism, they had the mentality of social Darwinism backing them up. But it's like these societies that exist, like in Haiti before the revolution, the American South, South Africa. It's just, I think the experience of living in close proximity, but close like fear of another culture, just creates in a culture such a hatred for them, because it's like you're not integrating with them, you're separated by some social mechanism, and then it just like fuels this really weird paranoid evil in societies. Like, it's really gross, honestly, but it's interesting, the South African example, because it's like who they were up against. So there are like British coloners at Cape Town, and then there's also the different African tribes in the area. Like being up against Zulus, that would be horrifying. Somebody that is like screaming and comes and kills you with an axe, like out right on the prairies of upper South Africa. Like that is terrifying. Like, I understand where the fear comes from, but it's just, like, sad to see it come back into racial politics and stuff.
But they're the ones who are going into the territory and making settlements. Like,
right,
it's like,
but I mean, at that point, they've been there for, like, 200 years, so it's like...
Right, but they were expansionist. And, like, you look at, like, the case of Rhodesia, which I bet the book will get to in the 60s. Like, Ian Smith declared independence, like... I think in almost like self-consciously styling it similar to like the American Revolution or like independence of other British colonies, but it's in the reverse. You know what I mean? It's a rejection of everything about liberal democracy, because the British Empire or I don't know what the hell it was called in the 60s, was like, you need to have home rule. Like, you can't have a white minority government. You need to enfranchise blacks. And they're like, well, we'll just defend our liberty. It's like this like bizarre perversion of the whole legacy.
It's the 1960s Confederacy, right? Like,
I mean,
the Confederates understood themselves as the second American Revolution, right? To protect their rights, right? At the against the fear that, you know, African Americans would receive social equality. So,
and dude, if you look at the way right wingers now talk about Rhodesia, before the Bush Wars really popped off, they're like, they talk about it just like the American, you know, racists talk about the antebellum South.
Jesus Christ.
You know, it's like this beautiful paradise.
Full of lily white angels.
Yeah, yeah. There's one, you know, one little elephant in the closet or whatever the expression is.
Yeah, one, just a little old elephant, a little toy elephant.
Just don't think about it.
I was going to say, though, I think that you would find similar sort of racial antipathy on like the American Western frontier, right? Like it's a, I think part of it too is that, you know, yes, the ultimate cause sort of, I don't know, cause and effect can kind of be difficult to parse here because, you know, when people who are often forcibly exported out to particular regions or, you know, leave due to, you know, lack of prospects at home, you know, what they're, you know, it's one of those kill or be killed situations where you're either going to try to make it yourself or you're going to die. And, you know, you don't really, you only care about the law insofar as you can bend it to work in your favor. So it's kind of like the both parties that are experiencing this conflict, you know, neither one is really, I would say, at fault for causing the conflict, right? Like it's all based on forces kind of mostly out of their control, especially in the earlier parts of these events. I mean, I don't think 1960s Rhodesia, I think that's more of a political choice and less of a being compulsed to do so, you know, by the external circumstances. But in the earlier phases, and then, like I said, when I think about the American West, I, you know, it's kind of like, well, I mean, you're a Russian, a recently freed Russian peasant, right, who comes over here to go make a life for themselves. Like, you're going to do it, you know, Comanche or not, right?
That is what I thought of. Well, James actually brings it up too. So thinking about that fear and hatred being like two sides of the same coin, he mentions how Americans loved British adventure because we see it as like cowboy and Indian. And he makes that a comparison when they start doing imperial propaganda films in the 20s that Americans really enjoyed it specifically for that because it reminded them of cowboy and Indian stuff.
Yeah.
So sort of as we've pretty much talked about the empire and, but I did want to ask sort of as like a final question, how has the nature of empire changed since World War II? You know, so we have the eclipse of the British Empire, the rise of the American Empire. How do we think that has changed? And then what do we think are like the key traits of an empire? And what makes the British Empire special compared to other cultures that we've encountered in our reading?
I think that like to have an empire like the British Empire's, you need an aristocracy or like a highly educated, I don't know what you call it, upper crust. Like, I think that's like an essential like key in it. Like they would send these highly educated people to far flung corners of the globe because you don't have instant communication. Like you need to have people who are capable leaders, but also like diplomats, generals. Like, I think that like that character of British culture is something that like they needed. And like, that was kind of, you saw that emulated in Japan and Russia as well. I don't know about anywhere else.
I think for it to be a real empire, it has to be multi-ethnic. Like if you're just a single ethnicity state, like, I think you can be a great republic or kingdom or commune, whatever it is, but I don't think you can really call it an empire. Like, an empire is something that's massive, it's sprawling. Since 1945, though, I'd say it's incredibly taboo to make empire based off of, like, conquering different ethnicities, or basically just conquering other people's land at all anymore.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's also, I think, as the British example showed, you know, not really feasible from a, like, a logistics point of view. I mean, most empire activities these days are done through either vassal states or soft power as a way of coercing people who already exist there rather than, you know, what the British ended up doing with India, which was basically try to rule it directly. And I would say that's probably the biggest change and partly a continuation of the British Empire policy to, you know, American international influence and, you know, its own sort of imperial activities, if not imperialism outright, is that idea of, you know, putting the right person in power rather than like a person you can work with, rather than try to, you know, to own and operate the land directly. Because if you can work with that person, then all of the commercial stuff, you know, kind of follows from it. I think as far as like key traits are concerned, like I think, Alex, it's a good point about the intellectual aspect of it. I would say Americans emulated that as well. And you could see that with like the, you know, the Ivy Leagues producing all these national security experts, and the, you know, that filled the bureaucracies of the American state. I would also say that, that empire is a, I don't know if you can say it's any more than like the political domination of, you know, I don't know, a certain amount of land, right? Or of people who are not indigenous to the political ruling party of a state. But, you know, as far as the British Empire is concerned, you can look at like the Romans or the Japanese, right? Like, I was just kind of struck in general by how dynamic the British Empire was at a political level, and how there were forms of redress that these dominions could go to. I mean, even the call for home rule, right, is kind of a, that would be unthinkable from, you know, like a ancient empire like the Romans. It would also be unthinkable in the Japanese Empire, right, or even the or the Russian Empire. It has, you know, it had a political history to it that was invoked by its critics, which is fascinating to me.
Well, I really do think that you had mentioned it a couple times, Sam, that they had their dominion system, they had the Commonwealth, and I feel like that dynamism was, one, the aristocracy and an energized leadership, but also mixed with this system of letting the people govern themselves to a certain degree. Like, ultimate decision was still kept in authoritarian hands of like generals and administrators, but they learned their lesson from America. Like, they lost their richest colonies and they reformed, and that's what allowed them to become like the ultimate imperialists.
And on that happy note, we'll end the podcast. Next week, we'll be reading the last part of The Rise and Fall of the British Empire by Lawrence James. Thank you everybody for listening. Have a great night.
See ya.
Night, everyone.